The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Thank you all very much for coming this evening. My name is Andy. I'm Director of Author Events here. And just a reminder to please turn off your cell phones. I think you've probably gathered from the titles of the two books that the theme this evening is fathers and daughters. We're a little late for Father's Day, but we'll play catch up tonight. I thought it would be fun if a member from each of the authors' families introduce them, just to sort of make it a little more personal this evening. So Alice will come up first, and her father, Jim, is going to introduce her. Please welcome Jim Rosino.
People, I've took it for granted that you probably know about the book, so I'm not going to speak about the book, except, of course, ask you to buy some. Beyond that, I thought I'd give you a couple of instances of why I'm very pleased with Alice. I used to tell my students all the time that brains is a gift from God. It's great to have brains, but that's a gift. It doesn't show your character. It doesn't show what you're made of. And I'll just give you a couple of instances why I'm so proud of my daughter. Her best friend is here tonight, Stephanie. And Stephanie started high school as a senior. My daughter Alice had been in the school all 4 years. And Alice is a born leader and a great leader in that she always has inclusion. She always brings everybody in. Everybody has fun. Nobody's made fun of. It was her first day of this particular club, and Alice is getting everybody organized. And Stephanie was sitting by herself, and that doesn't work with Alice. If you're by yourself, you're going to have Alice come sit with you pretty shortly. And she said, she brought Stephanie into the flow and introduced to her all her friends in this after-school club. And, of course, of doing this, Stephanie broke out in tears. And Alice said, well, what is this about? What did I say? And she said, today is my first day at this school. It's my birthday, and you're the first person who spoke to me all day. So that's the kind of nature she has. Another instance, she volunteers with an after-school group of kids that are almost to the high school, right, college level, but they're not quite there, and they need a little extra help. Alice has been volunteering there. She walks, I think it's almost 2 miles each way. One of her students, Manny, brought in a picture of his mother and displayed it. And apparently Manny has more than a little talent. And she said, Manny, what are you going to do with the picture? He said, I'm going to put it in the display. They're having an art, what's called a competition. It's like a sale, or you can display it. And he said, I'm going to put mine for sale. And she said, why would you do that? It's a beautiful picture of your mother. And he said, the only way I can buy her any gifts is if I sell the picture. Apparently, they're very poor. On her own idea, she went to the place where the pictures are for sale. If I'm not mistaken, the picture's around $74. She gave the money for the picture to the people and said, put your little yellow sticker. That means it's sold. But the idea was that after the competition or the show, she would give the picture back to Manny, and Manny could have it for his mother and still have the $74 for his mother's Christmas gift. That's the kind of thing that makes me very proud of her. As I say, brains are something you're born with, but what you do with it, that reveals your character. And one other thought, she's 6,000 books short of getting her bonus. I'm looking around. I suspect there's maybe 100 people. I do the math, and I get 60 copies each, and she's in the black. So keep that in mind. We'll sign them all night if it takes that. Here's my daughter, Alice.
Dad. We have an agreement he doesn't stay in while I talk. It makes me nervous. And sometimes we do it where he covers his ears and he doesn't pay attention, but this seat was right up front, and I said, this is not going to work. So he's readily leaving the theater. He might also recite picture books in the hallway. So this is for his height. So typically what I like to do when I do a reading is read my first chapter, very first thing, because anything you're wondering about why I'm here or who I am is covered by the first chapter, and then you don't have to wonder. And then I'll talk a little bit after. Okay. Each chapter starts with the day we are in our streak, and this will explain what I mean by that. So I start with the day, and then I use a quote from a book that we read together. And choosing the quotes was obviously really difficult because you've read, you know, you read so many books and they all seem really amazing to you, and how do you narrow it down? So when I stumbled across this quote, it really meant a lot to me because it was so simple, and it was the kind of thing you never see on a bookmark or a t-shirt. It's not played out, but it's kind of perfect. So chapter one, day one. "I am terribly afraid of falling myself," said the Cowardly Lion, "but I suppose there's nothing to do but try it. So get on my back and we will make the attempt." L. Frank Baum, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. It started on a train. I'm sure of it. The 3,218-night reading marathon that my father and I call the streak started on a train to Boston when I was in third grade. We were reading L. Frank Baum's The Tin Woodman of Oz, the 12th book in the beloved Oz series, a few hours into our trip. The woman across the aisle turned to us and asked why my father was reading to me on a train. We simply told her that this was what we always did. He had been reading to me every night for as long as I could remember, ever since we read Pinocchio when I was 4. Being on vacation didn't make much of a difference. Why not read? Why not always read? But her surprise made us think. If we were going to read on vacation anyway, how hard could it be to make reading every night an official goal? I suggested to my father that we aim for 100 consecutive nights of reading, and he agreed to the challenge. This is how I remember it. If you ask my father, though, as many people recently have, he'll paint an entirely different picture. "Lovey," he says, as I patiently endure his version of the story, "you're cracked in the head. Do you want to know what really happened, or are you just going to write down whatever thing comes to mind?" Lovey, as I'm sure you can guess, is not my real name. As are all things in my father's vocabulary, it's a reference to something. This time, it's Mr. Howell's nickname for Mrs. Howell on Gilligan's Island. My father never calls me by my name. Lovey is his most commonly chosen alternative. But when I drop something or forget something or do any of the silly things that we all manage to do on a regular basis, Lovey is often followed by phrases such as, "you nitwit." "So tell me then," I say, standing in his doorway as he gets ready to run errands. "Well, when did Mom leave?" he asks. "I was 10. "All right, so 1997 it started. The streak was a year old when she left. And what were we reading?" "Well," he says thoughtfully, "it had to be an Oz book. That's what we were into around that time. I wanted to try other things, but you were set in your ways. So far, we agree, but I know this won't last long." "We were on the bed. We just finished reading," he says, "and I was fearing the curse of Mr. Henshaw." "What is that curse?" "Dear Mr. Henshaw was the book I was reading to Kathy when she asked me to stop reading to her," he says in an almost whisper. It is clear that this memory, though nearly 2 decades old, still troubles him. My sister was in fourth grade when she said she no longer wanted my father to read to her. It seemed childish to her, especially since she was already reading novels on her own. But it wasn't so easy for my father. He was an elementary school librarian, and reading to children was what he liked to do best. And maybe next to being a father, it's also what he does best. His soothing voice and rehearsed facial expressions have won over thousands of children throughout his career. They won me over too, but I was already on his side. For some time, I'd been planning to suggest to you that we do a streak, because then at least you'd be a little older when we stopped reading together. I brought it up, and honest to Pete, I thought you were going to say we should read 100 nights in a row. He laughs as he recalls this. I don't laugh, because I think I did suggest 100 nights in a row, initially. "No," he continues, "right away you said, let's do 1,000. And I had to pretend to be enthusiastic, of course, but I wasn't too optimistic. 1,000 nights is a long time." I have to stop him there. None of this sounds right to me. First, I remind him that our goal had been 100 nights. When we reached that goal, however, and celebrated with a pancake breakfast at the local Greasy Spoon, we decided to set a new goal. We skipped the discussions of lower options, from 200 to 500, and ultimately decided to try for 1,000 nights. I tell him this, but he just shakes his head. When I try to explain that the streak actually began on a train, he cuts me off. "Ah, the curious incident of the train in the nighttime," he says, adapting the title of one of our favorite Sherlock Holmes stories. "I remember that part clearly," he continues, "because I never miss an opportunity to brag about what a good father I am." We were on the train to Boston, going up to see the sights for a weekend, and the woman next to us said how sweet it was that I was reading to you. I told her right away that we were on a streak, 40 nights in. I was pleased with myself, absurdly pleased with myself, pleased as a peacock to have made it 40 nights. We both laughed this time, but I am laughing partly because I know he is wrong. The train was the first night, obviously. The thing is, no matter how many times we're asked, we can never get this story straight. We agree on a few of the details, but I was very young and he's getting older. Some memories blend together with others, and our individual versions of how the streak started change so often, it's nearly impossible to come to some sort of agreement. We can't even remember when we started calling it the streak, or whose idea it was to do so. If we knew it would eventually reach over 3,200 nights and span almost 9 years, from elementary school till my first day of college, we might have taken notes in the beginning. Years passed before we even started keeping track of the books we read during Red Hot, another term for our nightly addiction, phrasing we found in The Great Gilly Hopkins. Just because we didn't know how it would end, though, didn't mean we took our streak lightly. Our rules were always clear and firm. We had to read for at least 10 minutes, but almost always much more, per night, every night, before midnight, with no exceptions. It should come from whatever book we were reading at the time. But if we were out of the house when midnight approached, anything from magazines to baseball programs would do. The reading should be done in person, but if the opportunity wasn't there, over the phone would suffice. Well, just barely. I could always hear the annoyance in my father's voice when I called to inform him that I was sleeping at a friend's. He'd sigh and put down the phone, and I'd wait for him to get back to our book. Sometimes, he'd ask me to call back in 10 minutes. "I haven't even pre-read it yet," he'd protest. He insisted on rehearsing, and with more adult books sometimes censoring our reading ahead of time. We remember the details from later in the streak better, both because they are more recent and because our record was becoming more impressive. Once we reached over 1,000 nights, close calls and readings at quarter to midnight became more nail-biting issues. Of course, we both remember how it eventually ended. That's the sort of event even my father can't forget, an event we dreaded for years. To get there, though, we need a beginning, and frankly, I don't know what that beginning is. I think I was leaning against him in the crook of his arm with my head on his chest as our train to Boston sped past houses and schools and baseball fields that became colorful blurs. We were already dedicated to L. Frank Baum and the Oz books. In fact, we were reading the entire series for the second or maybe third time. My father loved Baum's take on leadership and women, not to mention his spot-on Frank humor that made us laugh a little harder every time we reread something. I liked the wonderful descriptions of beautiful palaces, places like palaces and magnificent dining rooms filled with people and good food. Whenever we stayed in a hotel, which we were about to in Boston, I wondered if it was like the Palace of Glinda or Rinkitink. That night, as my father read the description of the palace in the Emerald City, with its marvelous banners and gem-encrusted turrets, I squirmed eagerly in my seat, excited to get to the Marriott and check in. I review this, and my father shakes his head. "That's how I remember it," my father insists, after repeating his story of the beginning, now for the third time today, the details varying just a bit each time. But then he sighs. "Problem with my remembrances, though," he admits, "is that they're always so goofed up." I sit for a minute, comparing my notes on both versions of the story, seeing what they have in common. I'm about to begin my argument once more, since simply repeating something over and over again sometimes convinces my dad that I am right, or at least wears him out. He knows I'm getting riled up, though, because his back is already to me as I'm about to begin my diatribe. "I'm going to go look for treasures in the coat closet," my father says, heading down the stairs. I'm not sure if this is a saying I'm expected to know or a literal plan, but it's apparent that the conversation is over. didn't think we'd come to an agreement anyway. But this is how I remember it. That's the first chapter. Yeah, you can clap. Thank you. I really enjoy doing events with my dad. A lot of the events I do are by myself. And those are, number one, lonely. But number two, I like... My impression of my dad is only kind of based in the way he actually talks. It's more like a caricature of the way he talks. So I like people to be able to hear him and then hear that it's at least coming from somewhere. That he has that like kind of funny voice. But I thought it was really cute. He looked up some information on the audiobook. He Googled the audiobook, and there was only one review at the time. And the review said that her father, who reads the introduction, sounds like a charming gnome. And since then, he's asked me several times if I think he sounds like a charming gnome. I tell him, no, just a gnome. So there were a couple things I wanted to touch base on, but I only have 15 minutes, which is plenty. So first, and possibly, this is a father-daughter sort of event, and I definitely want to talk about that a little bit. But I just wanted to say a little bit about this library system. First of all, I wanted to thank them for having me, and I think we should give them a round of applause because they're awesome. Thanks, guys. But we are so incredibly fortunate to have a library system that does things like this, especially in this economy where libraries are just kind of falling off the map everywhere we look. This is a wonderful system that we have here. You know, I don't know how often you go on the website and look at the calendar that they offer, but like, if it's 2 p.m. on a Tuesday, you've got six choices. It's awesome. You can go play Scrabble, or you can go to a lecture, and there's always something coming up. And I think this is a really underused resource, by myself included. I should be here every day, all day. What else am I doing? So I don't have a job. I'm looking. I want to be a teacher. Not certified. I think that, you know, this is a really great thing. I also wanted to share two very short stories about the library system around here. Number one being, and these are both the Philadelphia Public Library System, the student that my father talked about, the student I tutor, Manny, had to do this report. And he comes in and he says, "Have you ever heard of this or that country?" No, I hadn't heard of it. It was incredibly small. The population was like the size of Millville, New Jersey. It was just like this tiny little country somewhere in Africa. It didn't ring a bell at all. And he said, "Where am I going to find information?" And I honestly didn't know. I said, "I don't know, Wikipedia." I don't know, because I'd never heard of it. And he said, "I need to go to the library." So he pulls up the file and pulls up all the books. You guys had 7 books on this country. And there was one that was a picture book for children. Like, you want to learn about this tiny... I mean, I did. I was curious. But it's such a good resource to have. That's fantastic. We have such a wonderful system here. And the other thing I wanted to point out was my boyfriend does film work. And he's a sort of like a reporter. And we were covering... We as in I just go because I don't have anything to do. We were covering... the temporary closing of the library in Mount Airy. I don't know if any of you are familiar. They're like going under construction, I think. And so our job was to get people's reactions when they walked up to the library and saw that it was closed. And it was like someone had stabbed them. It was really serious. Like a little girl started crying. An older man came up and said, he said he was in the middle of a job search and he didn't have internet at home. And he said, "What am I going to do now?" And it really broke my heart. So now is the moment where I very lightly get on my soapbox and say, if you say you support libraries, I really encourage you to support them with your vote and your time and your money, because it really pays off. Okay, enough of my soapbox. Whenever somebody asks me what my book is about, my first reaction is to say that I didn't write a book, because then it just turns into this long conversation. So, but if they know that I wrote a book and they ask me what my book is about, half the time I say it's about books and half the time I say it's about family. And I think that's what makes this book special to me. I mean, and the fact that I wrote it, but the reason I wanted to write it was that literature and family overlap in so many interesting ways in our lives. I get all these emails. Every day I'll get an email, probably 6 a day, of someone who will say, "So-and-so read to me when I was a child those are my happiest memories. It'll be a grandmother, an aunt, and I don't even think that the people who send, the funny thing is the people who send those emails don't seem to understand that always they're reading to a kid. They don't make the connection that they're that person now. They just say, oh, I miss that. That was the greatest time in my life. It was so wonderful. I'm so appreciative that they did it. And I don't think that they pick up on the fact that that's you now. So, really, I would say never miss that opportunity. If you've got somebody hanging around your house, little kids, neighbors, people who just happen to wander into your home, plop them down on the couch and read for 10 or 20 minutes a night. I think it's going to make a really big difference in your lives, and those are going to be memories you have forever. I don't think many high school students were nearly as close as I was with my father. My father knew everything that was going on in my life, probably significantly more than he wanted to know. He probably didn't care for that. But the reading always gave us something to come back to. I knew he was going to be there at the end of the day. I knew we were going to discuss the books. And then every once in a while, I knew if we were reading a book, maybe about boys, he'd say, hey, have you talked to any boys lately? And I would say, no, of course not. Sometimes I had. But it's just such a wonderful jumping off point. It really is. And I think that you will, if you haven't started reading to someone yet, you will find that it can last you so many years. Another thing that I wanted to touch on in terms of family and reading is that I get a lot of emails that say, oh, but my kids are grown up now. I don't have anyone to read to. I wish I had done this earlier. And then somewhere in the course of the email, like a third of the time, they'll mention something about, I have an elderly parent and it just takes up a lot of my time and I have to take care of this parent. And I feel like, you know, stressed out and that I don't have enough time for reading. And to that, I always say there is always someone in your life you can be reading with, and there's always somebody who's really going to appreciate that. And if it's not the little people in your lives who wander in and out of your house, it could be the older people in your lives, the people who tend to feel forgotten, the people who are sitting in a nursing home wondering why you haven't stopped by in 2 weeks. If you showed up with a book, I think that would be amazing. If you showed up at all, I'm sure they'd love it. But if you show up with a book, I think that you're really going to touch a special place in their hearts. And I think my time is running out, so I'm going to wrap it up. But the final thing I sort of wanted to impress upon you, not that I had to impress anything upon you. I could have, you know, you're probably here to see him anyway. But I wanted to say that when we talk about family and the importance of family, I don't think you can ever underestimate the importance of the family that is your community. And you know, I live by myself in Philadelphia. Well, I live with two smelly boys, but I don't live with family. And I at times feel like a loss of family connection. I'm not living with my dad or my sister, and that's strange to me. But there are so many people in your community who would love to hear you read, would love to spend time with you. We're in such a modern age where the family structure has been redefined and redefined and redefined, and I think that's cool because we're changing. We're changing people, and everything is a family. But the family that I think we most often tend to neglect is our community, and there's a lot of people that you can get to know that you can read with. So I'm giving you a lot of options. You don't have an out this time. If you're looking to read with somebody, I made some pretty good suggestions, I think. And I think my time is up, so I'll let our real speaker come up. Thank you.
I'm glad you're short, too, because I'm really short. Hi, I'm Ella Strauss. My sister Sylvia is actually Daddy's little goalie, but I'm Daddy's little tennis player, point guard, coxswain, and fellow Sixers and Phillies fan. For more than a decade, he drove me to practices, early or late, and watched my games daily. He told me to think of an anecdote, and I thought of one. We have a really small town, so if you go running in my town, you're going to run everywhere. You're going to pass every house, all my friends. So, of course, there's the tennis courts where my high school tennis team practice every day from the middle of August till the last day in October. And it's nearing the end of the season. It's pretty cold out. I'm really kind of over practice. I don't even want to be there. So I'm not playing my hardest. And my friend's kind of goofing around too. And she goes, Ella, your dad's in the bushes. And I go, no, he's not. Like, I mean, usually he's in the gray Echo, so you can find him, which is a small, small car, but you can always find it. And I said, no, he's not. So I ignore it. And she's like, no, there's someone who keeps darting out of the bushes up top because it's kind of above the courts. And I go, he can't, it's so cold. What is he doing? Sure enough, I finally look up and there's my dad in a ski hat, sweatpants, sweatshirt, bright yellow, so I don't know how I missed him. And it's just my tennis practice, but he's there watching. He didn't want to miss my 15-minute match that I had at tennis practice. So that means he's there all the time. But even though I joke about it, I do appreciate it. It wasn't a game, but he still felt like it was necessary to see it. And it shows how my father, like Alice's father, chose to be part of my daily life. Maybe it was a bit much at times. I don't know for you, but for me sometimes. But this kind of person, a person like my dad and Alice's father, who goes way beyond what is expected and creates a worth reading story. So now I'd like to introduce my dad, Robert Strauss.
Well, I'm not reading tonight. I'm just going to talk for 15 minutes, and then Alice and I are going to come up here and answer your questions. But I was trying to think of anecdotes that are not in the book, and last night I came up with one that sort of shows, I don't know, why I wrote this book, and I'll get to that in a moment. And that is, whatever your thing is with your kid, I think, is your bond. I'm sure that if I was into opera, my kids would be into opera, because when they're little, they just love you, you know, like they just want to be with you, right, Jim? That's her. And but because I was a sports writer and, you know, Ella first and Sylvia sort of fell into this sports kind of thing. But those of you who grew up in Philadelphia know that that one of the great oxymorons is responsible fandom. Right? You can't, nobody, well, no, in Philadelphia you think you are, but if you're from somewhere else. Well, anyway, so Ella and I would watch 76ers games, and of course the Boston Celtics are the hated tribe, I guess. So anyway, I forget whether it was third or fourth grade, they have this little thing, and you have to fill out a little form of some sort, and it was like your favorite color and your favorite food and blah, 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 and, you know, and your most hated person. Well, why would you even have that? But still. So she puts down Antoine Walker. Well, for those of you who are sports fans, Antoine Walker could have been Mother Teresa, but he played for the Boston Celtics. So definitely an anathema. So, you know, she's sort of proud that she's probably the only third grader who knows who Antoine Walker is in the first place. But about 2 days later, 2 or 3 days later, she's in horror because now she's embarrassed. Like, what if Antoine Walker, you know, he's got a daughter too, probably, you know, third grade or whatever. So she makes me go to the school and ask the principal or the teacher, whatever, if she can change this before, you know, it gets published in some way. So that is, anyway, but anyway, these are the kinds of things that I want to remember going. I'm sure most of you have seen the stereotype of the crazed sports parent. Well, I'm a crazed sports parent in a certain sense, but I am that guy in the bushes that she talks about. At some point, you know, look, I was an older dad. I was 38 when I got married. My wife says that I just skipped my first marriage, just went right over it. And so I was 40 when Ella was born, and I decided that I was going to be at everything, whatever it was. You know, you probably must have had that same thought that, you know, you were going to be at everything, but you didn't quite know what it was. You picked what you picked. But sometime when, and this is an anecdote that's in the book, sometime about, I was about five, and I'm sitting watching a Sixers game on television, and much like Alice went into the crook of your arm, Ella goes in the crook of my arm, so, you know, I'm feeling sort of dad-like. And we're sort of watching the game, and a couple minutes into it, she turns to me and asks me the inevitable five-year-old question, not that particular question, but the kind of question. She says, "So, Daddy, why is it that only boys play sports?" So, like, I go like this. I'm shuddering, you know, and I'm shaking, and I say, "Well, yeah, yeah, girls play sports. Yeah, they must, you know. They play sports, sure." And I wasn't quite sure that they did, because when I was a boy, and I have one friend here, Al, who was a boy with me. Did girls play sports? I don't know. They didn't play with us, you know. Somehow, in my look in my high school yearbook, they did play sports. But how did they get started? Because they were not out of the streets with us. They were not in the Little League. They were not in the – certainly weren't in peewee football. And – but now – I don't know exactly when this happened, but probably around the 80s, there's this siren call for five-year-olds in the suburbs, the city, small towns, and everybody comes out, whether it's, you know, T-ball or bitty basketball or soccer, and they're out. So now girls do play sports. Now, I mean, do they continue or whatnot? But then but it's their choice now. So that's sort of the... To me, that's sort of the basis of this. But at this five-year-old moment, I said, but I'm going to try to be different. How am I going to be different? I'm pretty obsessive. So I was going to try to be different by being ubiquitous and sort of in the trees, as you saw. They do have a funny thing. There's a girl on the tennis team. Both of my girls play tennis. And so I've had a wide span of going to even Millville High School to watch tennis matches. I know where to be at the Millville tennis courts, which are not at the high school. That's where they're from, Millville. So that I can see the game and they can't see me. So that the one girl came up with a thing called Where's Robert? Because I would be there, but they'd have to find me. And, of course, once Sylvia came on the team, her younger sister, the second part would be that Sylvia had to go to me and make me go get snacks for the team. Anyway, so, you know, I can't remember very many of their tennis matches. I can't remember very many of their basketball games. I can't remember what they scored. But I do remember the moments that I want to remember, and these are the funny moments. And I wish that this was so. I don't pretend that this is an advocacy book by any means, although the Women's Sports Foundation called me last week and wants me to come up and be an advocate for dads in sports. So I view myself as this is my test. I'm going to be a motivational speaker. Like, I don't know. Who knows? But in any case, but the point is that I really like remembering sort of the goofy things. Sylvia and I just went to Richmond for the weekend for a lacrosse tournament. And I'm thinking, what are we doing in Richmond? I mean, aren't there other lacrosse games somewhere along the line? But my job for this summer lacrosse team, in my view, is to make all the parents feel good about their kids. Most of these parents are parents of kids who want to play college lacrosse or college something or other. So there's scouts all over the place, you know. Sylvia's claimed to me that she doesn't want to, and that's perfectly fine with me. But the team, what? How many games did they win? One this year, this summer? Sort of how many? Maybe 16. But I have the different scoring method, and that is the other team, if they have more players, gets minus a goal, you know. So if they have five more players, they have to score five more goals to actually win. Anytime the team wins a half, I tell the parents that you discount the first half or you discount the second half. So anyway, my view is that everything's supposed to have the point of everything is supposed to be fun. But you know, you are obsessed you are obsessed with your own kid too. And I tell this story a lot. I play basketball at a very, I play at a high level, but I was stunned 2 weeks ago. I was down the shore and somebody actually thought that I wasn't the worst player on the court. They had me guard some 14-year-old kid. You can imagine. You know, any time he didn't, he was just not smart enough to get to go past me. He didn't realize how much better he was than me until about 3 points left in the game. But that's life. Anyway, but one of the guys I play with actually still holds the record for scoring average for the Catholic League in Philadelphia for a season. I mean, he's approaching 40 now, but still. So you could still see he's a very good player. But he had little kids. A couple years ago, he had little kids, and they were just sort of starting in sports. And he says, "So Strauss, what's it like?" I go by my last name. He says, "What's it like having kids play sports?" I said, "Monroe, here's the story." He said, "There's 10 kids out there on the basketball court." I said, "9 of them are in black and white." He says, "And your kid is in blazing technicolor." I said, "And it never happens for me more than in tennis." Now, you know, they're actually very good in tennis, but Haddonfield has won the state championship the last 3 years. So they're like 14th on the team or whatever it is. But when I'm at that tennis match, you know, these kids who are like really spectacular, they're off playing over there. But, you know, I'm focused on my technicolor kids. And I'm looking for the moment that I'm going to remember. And the moment I'm going to remember isn't them winning 6-4, 6-4. It's not going to be that. It's going to be, well, my last little anecdote is one of my favorites with Ella, and that is the time she decided to be on the diving team at our swimming pool. Sylvia had been on the diving team, and she said it was fun, so Ella comes out, and when you're a young diver and you're just starting out, the mandatory things are front jump, back jump, some other kind of front jump, some other kind of back jump, and maybe a dive, you know. So it's not much. So we go over to the fancy swimming pool where most of her friends actually go, and they're there, and Ella's like, "Oh, my God, you know, how am I going to do this?" And she gets up, and she does all her required dives, and they then announce the places, and they go backwards, not from one to the end. But so Ella gets the sort of certificate for being 28th out of 28. So it's now about noon, and I look at her, and she's got this, she has a very good, when she's not so happy, her lower lip sort of goes down somewhere around her ankles, and she's holding this piece of paper with her scores and this 28th on it. And so I launch into the Newt Rockney thing, you know. "Well, great, you completed all the dives, you know, you didn't leave anything on the board." I don't know, is that what they say? You know, whatever I said, you know. And I look over there, and there are all of her friends who are, you know, born with fins, you know. And I say to her, I'm tearing up, you know, "It's noon, like, there's your friends, you know, go over." It's looking like, you know, the lip is still down scraping the floor. And she starts walking over, and all these girls start saying, "Ella, Ella, Ella." Came in 28th, but, you know, still had a good day. So that's I guess, my message of sports. It's not winning the great game, but sometimes I sign a book. I say, you know, there's a Grantland Rice, you know, he was a sort of a theatrical writer, and says, "When the great scorer writes against your name, it's not whether you won or lost," and I say, "but it's how you watch the game." All right. Thanks. So I think this is my other young daughter, Alice. By the way, buy her book.
So we've got folks in the aisles. If you have a question, please raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. Who would like to start us off? All the way in back, lady on the aisle.
Hi, thanks for coming tonight. You're very enjoyable to listen to, both of you. I haven't read either of the books. Alice, my question is for you. When you and your dad were reading the books, who chose the books? Did you take turns, or who was in charge of that? And were they your own books? Did you borrow them from the library? If they were your own, did you keep them? Do you still have them? And is there a list of your books?
Okay. You have to stop there.
A lot of questions. Okay. A lot of questions.
If you asked him, he would say, we chose them equally. I'll leave it there. He was an elementary school librarian, so a lot of the books came from his library. And a decent amount of them came from the public library, but his library was very well stocked because he was the one who stocked it. So we have a lot of the ones that we did read that we kept in boxes. My dad got the shed built that's like the shrine to the streak, and it's just box after box after box of books that we read together. A lot of them are Scholastic Book Fair books. That's a big way that we got a lot of our books, which is sort of funny because I wrote a chapter about that in my book and said we read so many Scholastic Book Fair books and we love Scholastic, and Scholastic contacted me and they said, we want to make you a book fair book. And I was like, this is so cool. So it's a book fair book. But we have those, and there is a list of everything we can remember in the back of my book. That list, if I had to take a guess, I would say it's about 80% of what we read, but... yeah, maybe by the third or, well, we're on the third edition. Maybe by the fourth or fifth edition, we'll remember some more. So far, that's all we've got. Thank you.
Robert, was that something that applied to you, too, in terms of did you pick your daughter's sports or did they pick their sports?
Oh, well, I think the story is this. It goes back to that sort of opera thing that I did. I think that when you're a little kid and you sort of like your dad, even though we still have arguments and maybe they don't like me so much anymore. But you know, you sort of follow what they're doing. And since I was a generally good but failed athlete, you know, I could do everything. And so I encouraged everything. You know, you want to go out for this? Great. But what I think about it is much like your streak. We didn't have a streak so much as... I compare this to if your kid. One reason why we chose sports, we could have chosen anything to talk about, to write about, or I chose to write about. So you could be in a play. If you're lucky, your school has three plays a year. If you're really lucky, they have three performances of every play. That's nine times a year. At Haddonfield, that's not a third of a tennis season. Hmm. If I'm out there 27. 30, 35, whatever. I didn't make everything, but I made pretty much everything. I'm sort of there with them, and we have something easy to talk about, much like the reading. So when there's something important to talk about, whatever it is, we've had this colloquy before about some stupid play in some game, some, you know, some funny moment, or you know, talking about some other kid who plays. My wife will tell you that I can be pretty, like, a martinet, you know, about certain things, picking up your crap or school or something. But in sports, I don't think, right? I mean, the girls can tell you. I don't think I ever would scream at them about anything. You know, I would never tell them they did something horribly or anything like that. It was always sort of these lighter... or, you know, critical in the sense of, you know, how the game went kind of things. So, like I said, the end result was supposed to be that we were buddies in some way. I don't mean friends. You can't be friends with your kids. I mean, it's in that same way. But So that's sort of my answer to that, the family answer to that, sort of the obverse of the of Alice and Jim in a sense.
Okay, another question. A lady in the blue.
This question is for both of you. I was wondering if you could describe your writing process, how you get started, if you use a computer, if you wrote it out by hand, if you kept diaries, or the process itself.
Go. Okay, I'll go. Well, I'm a writer for a living. And, you know, I write a lot. Some of my editors are here. I probably wrote, I've written tens of thousands of stories. So it's not hard. I never get writer's block. In fact, you know, just the way I run off with the mouth, I run off at the computer too. But you go to a party and they say, what book did you write? I had never written a book. 60 years old, I'd never written a book, you know. And so when I sat down to write this, it took me 3 years before I wrote the proposal. I would sit and do it like periodically. But then I threw it all out, and in April of last year, Sue, my wife, says, I don't want to hear about it anymore. You got a month to write it, and then that's it. So I wrote the proposal in a month. You know, I got the contract, you know, soon after that, and it took me 6 weeks to write the book. Nothing, you know. Because I thought about it for so long. It wasn't like I sat down and started from that moment and started that way. But for me, it's easy. But then I've been doing it for 40 years, you know, in a certain sense. So, yeah, I write at a computer. I had taken notes. But it's not like, you know, I say that I could have written a biography of Thomas Jefferson. It could have been the greatest biography of Thomas Jefferson ever, but it wouldn't have been half as easy or hard as this. You know?
I don't know. I'm probably one of the only people who's ever done this. If you've ever microwaved a CD, that's sort of what it's like. It's like when you put it in, it just instantly starts like sparking, and it makes this weird like lightning, and the room gets really sweaty, and then it's done. So that's sort of what I would compare it to. I will be honest, I did not enjoy the writing process. I would kind of like turn into this troll, and I would lock myself in my room, and I would just write and write and write and write, and then I would go for a walk. And so I started this habit of that I would go for a walk, you know, an hour every day, but I would get so worked up about my writing, and I would get so sweaty, really just like sweaty. I would get so anxious, I guess, that I would start going for other walks. So then by the end of the time of my writing process, I was going for like 6 walks a day, and then at some point I would write a chapter. And then at the end, I wrote on like a little netbook that weighs like half a pound. And at the end, I would like throw the netbook on my bed, and then I'd go in the other room like I couldn't even look at it. And then I would start it again the next day. So I wouldn't recommend my writing process. I didn't think it was a very good idea. But I did want to. I'm trying to think if I had anything worth saying about it. I think I had the advantage of having a really amazing editor who was nothing like me. And I would totally recommend that if you're looking for a good editor pair for you. I found that having somebody who wasn't like me made things so much easier, because she said, well, what do you mean by that? And I said, what do you mean, what do I mean? It's obvious. And she'd say, it's not obvious to me. And she's like much more settled. She's 30, but she acts like she's like, you know, 45. I don't make it sound too bad, but she's like she has cats and a husband, and she's just so sweet. And I think that having somebody who was very different from me made the process much more frustrating, but better.
In the back, Stephen on the left.
I have a question more for Bob, but I guess both of you can answer it. I always find one of the interesting issues with memoir, which both of your books are, is whose version of the story gets in the book. So I'm curious whether you fact-checked with your family members, if they had a different version, whose version you used, and how you went about that process.
Well, it's Rashomon, right? I mean, it is my version. Sue read over the book and had me change three things, and she was adamant about changing them. And one of them was, I remembered an incident, and I think it's really sort of, it sort of tells you about obsessive sports appearances, that I remember the incident this way. And there was, Ella was in some town soccer league where half the kids wanted to kick the crap out of the other half of the kids, and the other half of the kids didn't even want to be there. But a parent took a girl up to the supervisor of this, you know, ramble out there, you know, 6 to 10 year olds or whatever age they were, and was demanding more playing time for her daughter. Well, playing time, I say, is like a wife joke to Henny Youngman. You know, it's like there is never enough. You know, there can never be enough playing time if there are 24 hours in a day to an obsessive sports parent. Their kid should be on the field for 25. So this kid is like, in my memory of this, is like trying to, you know, dig a hole and be somewhere else while her mother is telling this other woman about it. And the other woman says, if you want a scholarship, play the oboe, which is what every sports parent should hear. Sue, of course, remembers it a different way. I don't remember exactly what it was, but that's the point is that it's my memory, and you got to live with it.
I did a lot of, I would start a conversation and not, I assume at some point, he's a smart man, he probably figured it out, but I wouldn't say I was asking about the book, and I'd say, you remember that time? What do you remember about that time? Like, specifically, what season was it? And then we would just have more of a conversation, but I didn't, so we made a deal that he's never going to read the book. Yeah. And I didn't run it by him. He's never read the book. But the closest I came, my sister is like, so she remembers everything. She'll say, like, you were wearing that sweater and it looked awful on you. She remembers everything. So I wasn't going to let her read the book because I said, you're totally going to disagree with everything I write and this is going to be awful. And she read the book and she said, I found one glaring error. And I said, what's that? And she said, you said you used to have clammy hands. So she has a pretty good memory. And if that's, I mean, they're clammy right now. So if that's the only thing she found, I'm content with that. I have a surprisingly good memory in a lot of ways. But the thing that I found, maybe you found this too, was I just only wrote about the things I had a surprisingly good memory for. There were some things I was like, that's interesting. Don't remember anything about it. So if I didn't remember it, I didn't write about it. Made it a lot easier.
Got time for one more question. Who'd like to take us out? Gentleman with the blue hat.
Well, it's one thing to be a devoted parent. But this guy has not only been a devoted parent, but he's easily the hardest working journalist in Philadelphia in the last 30 years. And so it makes the accomplishment of attending all of his children's sporting events all the more impressive. So it's not a question as much as it is a vote of admiration.
Oh, thanks, David. The one thing I want to I also like libraries, you know. I once spent my first thing that I worked on a book with a guy named Dan Rottenberg many years ago called Finding Our Fathers, and I was his research assistant in this library. I spent hours and hours and hours in here with him, and I cross-referenced the Jewish Encyclopedia, which is, I don't know, long, many. It was like, and it would be like Morris Cohen married to Becky Stein. So I'd have to say Cohen, Stein, Page, you know, whatever it was. But it was great to be here. We were in these big rooms with books around us. And there is something about libraries that are different than, I don't know, reading a Kindle. I hate to say it. I mean, I'd be happy if you buy my book on Kindle, but still, you know. So I want to say that to second what Alice said. But also, I want to say that everybody should write something about their kids, or if you don't have kids, about someone that you want to have them remember your memories. Like Stephen's asking me about, it's your memory. It doesn't necessarily have to be right. I mean, it has to be right in that great overall sense of that rightness. But I have one little thing that my mom wrote about me, and I treasure it. It's in my desk drawer. I was sick for a while when I was, who knows, 5, 4. And she wrote every day when I was sick. And this one day, this one passage, it's only yay long, but I think she thought I was going to die. I got some ridiculously high fever. The doctor came to the house, you know, patted me down. We saved, and whatever it was, you know, she has had a nice way of writing. But that's it, you know. So at the very least, I've written many stories with my kids in mind, like what I thought they should know. But this one was really, as I'm writing it, I realized that when after I started, it was really for this sort of future generation. So I did try to write funny stories because I like to be funny. You know, everybody likes to be entertaining, I suppose, and they like to be serious or funny. But the point of it is the point of it now is that I encourage everybody to like jot it down. It's so easy. You got a computer now. You know, you can talk into a tape recorder. But save something for those kids. You know, save something for your parents, even if you're too old. Your kids are gone. So that's what I would tell them. Same way, you know, Alice will always have this. I mean, she may never write another book, or she might write 50 other books. She says she's not, but come on, she's a kid. She'll write more. Maybe you'll write that biography of Thomas Jefferson.
I just wanted to say that before we wrap up, that reading his book was literally the most educational book I've ever read. I've never played sports. I don't know anything about sports. And this book, if you don't, you will. And it's not instructional. It's not informational, but he uses all these terms in ways that I was like, what is that? And, when I was reading it, for example, I was on vacation, not vacation, but touring. I like to call it vacation. It makes me sound cooler. And, I called my boyfriend that night, and I was like, oh, I'm learning so much from this book. And he was like, what are some of the examples? I was like, field goal. So I think you'll really enjoy it. It's really well written.
I think we've all enjoyed both of you. Alice Osma, Robert Strauss. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.